Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Some major developments on the COVID-19 story this past week. The whole province of Ontario is now moving into the second phase of its attack on the coronavirus. Toronto and Peel are coming out of lockdown. And with any luck, the province's top vaccine logistics guy says every eligible Ontarian who wants a shot will have one by the first day of summer. That, plus a major announcement from the NDP on its new ambitious climate change plan, plus election expenses reform from the government. Tons to discuss on this Tuesday, March the 9th, 2021. So let's get to it. JMM, Ontario is moving into phase two of its fight against COVID-19. Tell us what that entails.
So we are here discussing the second phase of the vaccination drive. The initial phase was really focused on long-term care homes, hospitals, retirement homes, what I think of as the firefighting stage of vaccination. And now we are moving on to phase two, which is going to open up vaccinations to a much larger number of people. I guess you could generally just think of it as the general population, though there are priorities within that general population. They're looking at three major factors. Age is still the biggest factor when we are talking about COVID ending in hospitalization or death. So that is still the most likely factor in terms of when somebody will get a vaccine. The other factors that they are looking at are both health conditions. So, you know, we know that there are some pre-existing health conditions that make COVID infections more severe. And they're also looking at geography, postal code, basically. If you live in an area that has been particularly hard hit, you may be further up the list in terms of getting access to a vaccine, even if you are not necessarily the in the oldest age group available. So this is all basically spelled out in a plan that was made public on Friday. We published it at tvo.org, and I'm sure you'll be able to find that online if you want to look for it. And that basically rules out that the pledge that you've already mentioned, Steve, that the government is at least the formal document says the government is hoping to have everybody vaccinated by the end of July, partially vaccinated by the end of July.
Well, you use the word plan, and I well remember the boxer Mike Tyson, who said everybody who walks into a ring has a plan until they get punched in the face. And then, you know, things may change. So, yeah, we got a plan. But here's what General Rick Hillier told reporters at Queen's Park on Friday afternoon, not long after that plan was released.
And our aim would be is to allow the province of Ontario to have a first needle in the arm of every eligible person who wants it by the first day of summer. That's kind of the challenge goal I put out there. The first day of summer, 20 June, coming up, obviously. And that's not very far away. So when I say, please be patient a little while longer, we will get to you. And we'll get to you much more quickly than we ever imagined before.
Okay. You want to read between the lines of all that?
You know, this is, I think, a really great example of how quickly things can change in politics, in government. To give people the background here, you know, we were briefed on this plan on Friday morning, and just hours before they made the plan public, the federal government had announced two really significant pieces of news. They were announcing the approval by Health Canada of a fourth vaccine, this one developed by Johnson & Johnson. And they also announced accelerated shipments of the vaccine developed by Pfizer. That's the vaccine that really everybody has been relying on in Canada more than any of the others. And we are going to get a bunch more later in March and April than we had been anticipating. So, you know, just in terms of the few hours between those announcements, the plan as it had been laid out to us was already out of date because we had, in fact, much better news and many more vaccines coming in than we had planned.
Right. And some of the things that officials think will be game-changing include waiting 4 months instead of the 3 months between getting the first and the second vaccination shot, which would be the case with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, And then AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson are expected to be available soon. So not to mention hospitals, primary care centers, mass vaccination sites, pharmacies, they're all being brought on board to vaccinate people. So if you add all that up, what does it suggest in terms of how quickly we're actually going to be able to tackle this virus?
You know, at the risk of sounding overly dramatic, I do think that the 7 days between Friday, February 26th and Friday, March 5th may end up being remembered as some of the most consequential in the pandemic, really, at least in Canada. The combination of news we have received, right? Remember, this is just really a week and a half ago, as you and I record this, that AstraZeneca got approved, and we got that news that there was a large shipment coming in, even with that early approval. Now Johnson & Johnson, the expansion of that dose interval to 4 months or 16 weeks, that's really important. That's going to basically allow a very large percentage of the population to get partially immunized much, much sooner than we had planned. You put it all together, this is really some of the best news we've had in a year. I was saying to another reporter, like, it's the best 7 days we've had since the pandemic began. And, you know, life may not return to normal exactly by Canada Day, but it's going to be a lot closer to normal than I think I was anticipating. I mean, I was optimistic that we were going to have a sort of return to normalcy by Labor Day, maybe. But things are moving along really, really quickly. You know, not everything is a known yet. We don't know what the public health guidance is going to be for people who are partly immunized but haven't gotten their second shots, because that's going to be into July and August when that happens. And we also don't know about immunizing kids. We still have really no discussion about what immunizing people under the age of 18 is going to mean, how that's going to happen. But, you know, we're getting there.
Mm-hmm. There was a rather famous photo op that took place this past week as well, and that is, who do I always mention whenever I can on this podcast, John Michael?
I believe that would be TVO's patron saint, former Premier Bill Davis.
You are correct, sir. And 91-and-a-half-year-old Mr. Davis went and got his shot in Brampton, he and his wife Kathleen. So, and the Mayor Patrick Brown went along and watched that take place, and that was a big photo op, and I tweeted a picture of that out, and it's amazing how, I mean, the guy's been out of public life for 36 years, and yet whenever he makes an appearance somewhere, there's still a lot of very positive chatter that accompanies his appearances. So congratulations to the Davises for getting their shots. Maybe one last thing we should mention on COVID here. We did learn last week that 1,500 doses of the vaccine have, what they say, have gone to waste. But General Hillier insists that that's very, very little by comparison, and we're actually doing pretty well on that score. Now, it's hard to imagine that wasting can be a good news story, but maybe you can put it into context for us.
Right. So in terms of the total number of doses that Ontario has taken into its possession from the federal government, this is much, much less than 1%, something like 1 to 2/10 of a percent of the total number of vaccines have been wasted. And we don't really know what those numbers are in other provinces. So we can't really compare how well Ontario is doing relative to Quebec or Alberta or BC, for example. But just on the sheer numbers that we're talking about here, you know, I have a really hard time believing. You could have told me that the number was 10 times higher, like 1 or 2%. And I would have basically understood, because this is still a human system with, you know, we are all still learning how to handle these vaccines. They are finicky beasts that require lots of complicated refrigeration. And if you had told me that in the first few months of learning how to use them, we had accidentally wasted 1 or 2%, but 98 or 99% had gotten into people's arms, I would have basically said, yeah, that's to be expected. One other point of comparison we do have is the flu vaccine, which every year something like 5% can end up being wasted. Now, obviously, COVID is more deadly than the flu is. The flu, of course, can end up killing people. As you say, nobody wants to waste 1,500 doses of the vaccine, but absent some other context to suggest that Ontario was being particularly sloppy, it's hard for me to get angry about this one.
Mm-hmm. I think you inadvertently just announced the title of your memoirs, which would be John Michael McGrath, colon, Ontario's finicky beast. Had not heard that expression before. That's a good one.
I'm not planning on writing my memoirs anytime soon, but I will keep that one in mind.
Yeah, but just put it on the back burner. I think it's a good one. Okay, let's get to some non-COVID news. And that starts with the official opposition at Queen's Park. That's Andrea Horvath and the NDP. On the weekend, they unveiled, Saturday morning, in fact, a very ambitious $40 billion plan to fight climate change. Now, you and I both have columns up on the website, tvo.org, with both the details and potential political impact of what they're calling the Green New Democratic Deal. And we'll put the links to those in the show notes. But, well, before we go any further, why don't you just give us some of the highlights of the Green New Democratic Deal?
I think the key thing that I would focus on, the NDP are proposing to bring Ontario back to a cap and trade system. This would sort of bring us back to the system that we had under the Liberal government, under Kathleen Wynne, though the NDP say theirs would be a fairer system. It would also mean that unlike the federal carbon tax, this money would end up in provincial hands. At the moment, the federal carbon tax gets distributed to taxpayers as a rebate for the most part, and the province really doesn't see that money in any sense. And you know, the federal government doesn't get to spend that money on anything it wants to either. But the NDP are proposing to raise $30 billion with that cap and trade system over 4 years. That's about three quarters of what they're planning to spend. The rest would be made up with green bonds. And, there's some potential political impacts to that. I think, at least some Ontarians have probably gotten used to getting those carbon tax rebates, and that would really disappear under the NDP proposal. There's a bunch of stuff in the plan, and certainly I linked to it in my column. If people want to read the full plan, they can. There's a lot of stuff that I think is very familiar there: support for electric vehicles, support for the auto sector to make electric vehicles here, making more environmentally efficient homes and office buildings. The other thing that is in there that I really wanted to highlight for people is a pledge they make about nuclear power, not to expand nuclear power unless they say that we can solve the storage and cost issues. And, nuclear power, very controversial. I'm not going to get into all of that right now, except to say that there are two key items that I think any future government is really going to have to face in the next term after the next election. And that is basically a deal, an agreement that Ontario has signed with other provinces to develop a new type of nuclear reactor, and at least getting part of the way to storing Ontario's spent nuclear fuel, which is a legacy of decades of nuclear power in this province. I have a bit more of that in my column for the website, but as I say, there's a bunch more in the NDP document. I would encourage people, just as active citizens, to give it a read. But those were the two that stuck out for me.
Did you notice the color of the document?
God, I'm not even sure I do recognize or notice these colors anymore. But was it green?
Well, that was what. That's one of the things I found interesting about it, is that it was on the left hand side of the title page, orange, and then morphing into green. And it seemed to me, as I was looking at this thing, that it was pretty obvious who this thing was sort of aimed at, and that is Green Party supporters. It is, after all, called the Green New Democratic Deal. The colors are orange and green. At her news conference, Andrea Horvath talked about why the Tories and the Liberals could not be trusted to improve the environment, but the one party that she did not mention in any of her comments was Mike Schreiner's Green Party. And when it came to the Q&A afterwards, I even asked her, Andrea, isn't this plan designed to take dead aim at Green Party supporters and the leader, Mike Schreiner? And she said, no, it's taking dead aim at climate change. And off to the races she went, once again, not even mentioning Schreiner or the Greens. So my hunch is, politically, this plan is the NDP's way of saying to Green Party supporters, and perhaps environmentalists who are wavering about voting Liberal, come to the NDP. We've got a great plan. We've got an ambitious plan. We're only 23 seats away from an NDP majority government. So if you don't like the Ford Conservatives, we're the best alternative. Obviously, we'll find out in June 2022 how effective this entreaty to people who care about the environment will be. But in terms of the politics of the thing, that's who I saw this plan definitely aimed at.
You know, there is also, of course, this moment that we're having both in U.S. politics and I think federally of, you know, even just look at the name of the document, right? Very clearly invoking the idea of the Green New Deal that, you know, I think is most closely associated with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the U.S. And, you know, it's interesting. The NDP under Horvath, I think you could fairly say since 2011, I guess, you know, they've bounced around a little bit, I would say, politely. You know, they have not always been really stalwart left-wing party. You know, I think Horvath's early two elections were much more sort of designed to try to appeal to centrist voters. And that's one way to try and win an election. I have no objection to that. But it is interesting to me to see them really make a play for a much more left-wing and like ardently left-wing voter.
Yeah. And in fact, the Green Party just sent me an email this very second because I mentioned in my piece the fact that the Alberta NDP, of course, supports building pipelines in Western Canada. And the Greens here in Ontario point out that the Ontario NDP has been in support of and favored the Enbridge Line 5 pipeline, as the, according to the Greens, as shown through their vote in the House last week. So, you know, it's been complicated being a New Democrat and an environmentalist at the same time. There are endangered species in Northern Ontario, which environmentalists really care a lot about, and a lot of New Democrats up there don't care that much about because they're more interested in logging and timber and forestry and mining jobs. You could say the same thing about down here in the South, where a lot of environmentalists who want to love the NDP aren't thrilled about the fact that the NDP also wants the votes of auto workers who up until now have made a lot of big pickup trucks and gas-guzzling cars in places like Oshawa. So the NDP's always walked this tightrope. They seem to be walking less of a tightrope with this plan, which seems very much planting their flag on the side of environmentalism and a new greener economy. Anyway, as we mentioned, John Michael and I both have pieces up on the TVO.org website, and you can read a couple of different takes on this. Let's talk housing. And, you know, the financial accountability officer, whom we've had on this program in the past and whose reports we've often discussed because they're often very good, they've got a new report out about housing and homelessness. And JMM, you have read the report, so why don't you take us through some of the bullet points on that?
Well, regular listeners will know that I love me some reports from the FAO, and I love housing policy. So this was a pleasant diversion from the pandemic. Or, you know, it would have been, I guess, except that the reading is kind of grim. The FAO found that an unanticipated side effect of the current national housing strategy, this was the plan brought in by Justin Trudeau's Liberal government a few years ago. One of the unanticipated side effects is that, at least for right now and the next year or two, there's actually going to be less public money going towards affordable and social housing programs in Ontario.
Well, the National Housing Strategy is a decade-long, multi-billion-dollar commitment from the federal government, and you're telling us that we'll actually be spending less than we were before?
You know how I love to make lessons out of these kinds of things. So this is a bit of a lesson in government. When the federal government and the provinces make these big billion-dollar spending commitments, they do so with formal agreements. These are, you know, like contracts written out, signed, etc. And these agreements are usually time limited. So one thing that is happening right now is that a bunch of agreements that were made and signed before the National Housing Strategy was created, they are now expiring. And they have not yet been replaced entirely by the new programs in the NHS. So what that ends up meaning, as a for example, is in the current fiscal year, Ontario will spend $562 million on housing programs, and it will be about $600 million next year. Now, that number is going to keep growing, but as recently as 2017, the province was spending $1 billion in 1 year, and nothing in the future is projected to match that.
So do we infer from that that means fewer families actually being helped into homes that they can afford?
Well, and this is why I said it's kind of grim reading. Because the GTA is so expensive to live in, and because so much of the province's population either lives here or is trying to live here, the FAO reports that the number of households in what is called core housing need, people who spend more than a third of their paycheck on rent, that number is going to grow from 735,000 to over 815,000 by 2027. And that's even as the amount of money being spent on housing continues to grow.
Okay, let's move from housing to religion. Yes, religion. We're going to talk religion on this podcast. In the U.S., it is frequently the case that religious leaders get deeply involved in politics. In Canada, not all that much. It's quite infrequent for ministers of the cloth to try to influence ministers of the crown, at least from the pulpit and at least publicly. Well, we saw a significant exception to that this past week. The Archbishop of Toronto, Thomas Cardinal Collins, has urged his Catholic flock to write their MPPs and get the province's churches open again. Okay, JMM, what's the case that he's making there?
You know, this was a really interesting case and notable because Cardinal Collins was actually a very strong defender of public health measures in the pandemic early on, and wrote with, I thought, some real power to Catholics, saying that, you know, as much as the church and its believers have been persecuted in the past, you know, they need to stay home for the good of themselves and their families and the church. And now I think it's fair to say that the Cardinal is quite frustrated with a situation that he sees as basically unfair to religious observance. The example that he gave in this message that he sent out to Catholic believers was that a movie that was filmed in St. Michael's Cathedral was able to have, you know, a great number of people there and a lot of activity, but they are actually forbidden from having religious ceremonies in the exact same building at more than 10 people. And, you know, the Eaton Center, for example, is not that far from St. Michael's, and it will be allowed to open to a limited amount of retail, but it will be in numbers far greater than the number of people who are allowed in St. Michael's. So, you know, very frustrated time for the Cardinal. And, you know, to his point, this is now going to be the second Easter that Catholics basically won't be able to observe in Toronto because obviously the first wave of the pandemic made that impossible. And now, even as Toronto starts to open up very slightly with the changes in this week's public health measures, still, Catholic churches and you know, any Christian church observing Easter in the pandemic, or in Toronto rather, is just not allowed to have that many people in.
Yeah, I was quite stunned actually at how strong the language was in Cardinal Collins's press release, in which he said, "Next week, a funeral at St. Michael's Cathedral, capacity 1,500, will be capped at 10 people, while around the corner, dozens can enter the local liquor store and thousands will visit the Eaton Center. This makes no sense." Those are the Cardinal's words. And we have seen before, John Michael, numerous occasions where a lot of people don't think that all the protocols make a heck of a lot of sense, as in shutting down all of small business and yet permitting the big box stores to be open and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people teaming into these big box stores, where they're obviously not going to be able to avoid each other, whereas small business has a way of doing it in such a way where only 5 or 10% of the people capacity go in at once, and yet they weren't, when we were shut down, they weren't allowed in at all. You know, some of the stuff, is the Cardinal right? Some of this stuff seems to make no sense.
Well, you know, I think it is certainly fair to say that people feel that these measures are not always 100% consistent. The difference between the liquor store and St. Michael's Cathedral, or the Eaton Center for that matter, is that people don't sing loudly in the liquor store, or at least not any of the liquor
stores. You haven't been to some of the liquor stores I've been to, obviously.
Well, it's also been a while since I've been at Mass, but I do remember at least some of the hymns. And we know that singing is associated with more spread of COVID-19. This is still a disease that is spread primarily through, enclosed spaces and crowds and people singing and talking loudly. And, you know, obviously masks can help mitigate that somewhat. Maybe the proper threshold for St. Michael's is higher than 10 people. It would not surprise me if maybe they could go to 100 without a huge risk. But I also understand why public health doesn't want to be in the position of having to arbitrate all of these cases on a church by church basis.
No, that's for politicians to do. So we might look for them to take a little leadership here. Anyway, let's follow the money here. Finally, there have been changes yet again to Ontario's political fundraising laws. And you may remember back in the day, it was considered a bit of the Wild West in our province. Restrictions not particularly tough. Then Kathleen Wynne's government put in some very strict rules. Some thought actually too strict. For example, you remember when politicians were actually not allowed to show up at their own fundraisers because they put such new tough restrictions in place. Anyway, now the current PC government has loosened things somewhat. JMM, they've doubled the amount you're now allowed to contribute. What else is different?
Probably the one that is most notable around Queen's Park, because it was kind of a surprise, is that the government has decided to not only keep the per vote subsidy that they had initially proposed to get rid of, but they are actually extending it and increasing it. So, you know, this was a campaign promise by the Progressive Conservatives in 2018 to get rid of the per vote subsidy that, you know, many conservative parties have really never believed that this was a good policy for government to effectively subsidize political parties. They are now changing their mind, and they say that it's because in the context of a pandemic, it's more difficult for political parties to raise money. And this is a gesture towards fairness for the other political parties. This is going to mean millions of dollars that neither the Liberals nor the NDP were expecting, but anybody who can do the math. But of course, the Tories received the most votes in 2018, and so they will receive the biggest single windfall from this policy change.
Right. Let's do one more financial bit here. The Ontario Liberals just announced this past week that they have retired the entire $10 million debt they incurred to fight the last election. And they've done it in just over 2.5 years. This is really, I have to say, this really is quite an accomplishment, given that the party isn't even an officially constituted party at Queen's Park, because they only have 8 seats after all, not the 12 required. Their leader, Stephen Del Duca, doesn't have a seat. And obviously the ability to hold normal fundraisers has been dramatically hampered over the past year because of the coronavirus. So with the next election in June 2022, the Liberals, in part because of the news you just related, and in part because of the work they have done, they are in a decent position financially to compete.
You know, one thing that did occur to me, and I wonder how much this is true, and I don't know, but, you know, the inability to hold, you know, big fancy fundraisers, the, you know, $1,000 a plate fundraiser, you know, those get the headlines and those bring in a lot of money, but they're also very expensive to throw. And what parties have been left with because of the pandemic is basically just online fundraising, which is a very cheap way to raise money. And so I wonder if the pandemic has sort of accidentally made politics more lucrative for political parties. In the interest of equal time, we will just also add that the official opposition, the New Democrats, are also in a pretty strong financial position. I think we may have mentioned this before, but they have raised almost as much money as Progressive Conservatives in 2020. Some of them that I spoke to are frankly a little mystified by the government's change of heart on the per vote subsidy. One person I spoke to said that, you know, of all the businesses in Ontario that have been shut down by the pandemic, partisan fundraising is absolutely not one of them. So it was a bit of a confusion, but they're not going to, yeah.
They're not going to say no to the money though, are they?
No, they are not.
Right on. Well, we always conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, and we'll have those for you immediately after we ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We do love to know what you like, what you didn't like, and maybe help us make this program a little bit better.
Or you can send us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org.
Here now is my quote of the week. We're going to go back to last Friday when General Rick Hillier, who's Ontario's COVID-19 logistics coordinator, said he'd talked to lots of healthcare people who told him they love the efficacy of the COVID-19 vaccine to the point of doing gymnastics about it. Here's the general.
This is a great vaccine. And I just quote to you the words of Dr. Robin Williams, who advises our team. And she said, you know, this reduces hospitalization and death in a huge way. And she said, it's a good vaccine. If we could get the flu vaccine to that level of efficiency, all the medical professionals would be doing cartwheels. They'd be so happy with it. It is a good vaccine.
I like the way General Hillier says huge, right? That's a Newfoundlander's way of saying huge. That was a huge quote from General Rick Hillier, former chief of defense staff, now running logistics for the Ontario government's vaccine rollout.
And my quote of the week is from Andrew Horvath, and our listeners might expect that it would be something about their new climate plan, but it is not. It is about something else the NDP leader was asked about on Monday, the interview of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle by Oprah Winfrey, and one new Democrat MPP's call to defund the monarchy. Horvath was asked about that at Queen's Park on Monday, and here's what she said.
Well, Richard, you know, I have to say that monarchies have never necessarily been my favorite system of government. I was pretty shocked at some of the things that were said in the interview last night. The issues around racism, the issues around mental health were pretty troubling.
And that is, I guess technically her title is not Her Majesty's Loyal Opposition, but the official opposition leader, Andrew Horvath, at Queen's Park on Monday. Did you happen to catch that interview, Steve?
I'm going to let you take a guess on that one. What do you think?
I don't know. Was there a hockey game on instead?
There was something on instead.
Okay.
No, believe it or not, I PVR'd it. So I intend to watch it at some point, but I have not seen it yet.
Yeah, with events like this, I tend to catch the clips the next day, I got to say.
The journalist in me would say those are some pretty troubling allegations, but that's one side of the story. We should wait to hear what the other side of the story is and then make up our minds.
Queen has no problem or no trouble getting her story out when she needs to.
That is absolutely true. Everybody wants to hear from the Queen and or her minions. So, and with that, we bring to a close episode number 102 of the On Poly podcast, produced by Katie O'Connor, editing by Matthew O'Mara, production support from Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell. JMM, as my dad likes to say, stay positive, test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.